Well, good afternoon. We're going to get started right on time and hope that other people will be joining us as they pick up their lunch and get ready. And thanks so many of you coming. I know that it's always a challenge in the last day, in the last session, and our brains are full. And maybe our pockets are full also with all the cards of all the contacts we're going to make when we get back. But I'm very pleased to be here today with you. I'm Sharon Moffitt. I'm the Chief of Health Promotion and Disease Prevention at the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. And with me today presenting, we've got a few changes in speakers, but one of the critical principal presenters here today with us is Dr. Jewel Mullen. Dr. Mullen is the current president of ASTO, and you're going to be hearing directly from her about her challenge on the healthy aging work that ASTO and with her direction our colleagues throughout the country will be working on. And then also joining us today is not Brenda Fitzgerald, although the name tag may say that. Dr. Fitzgerald is the health commissioner in Georgia and was not able to be with us. And fortunately, Russell's been able to join us, and we're very pleased to have him join the day with us. And maybe what I can do as we're kind of getting started here, I want to give you kind of an overview of ASTO, the nature of our work. I'm going to also be presenting some conceptual models so you can understand kind of how we approach and think about our work. Then we're going to give you some very specific examples of some of the work in the that we've already done that have led up to our healthy aging work, specifically some of our work related to Healthy Brain Initiative. Additionally, we'll be presenting some important ideas, two for your consideration of a strategic map that we use to guide our work. And then I'll be turning over to Dr. Mullen. Let me take just briefly a moment to mention, beyond being the ASTO president, she is the commissioner of health in Connecticut, and prior to that was the chronic disease director in Massachusetts. She brings a wealth of knowledge and experience, and Dr. Mullen will speak also to some of her expertise in the area of working with the elder in her clinical world. So a richness she brings to this work, definitely. And then Russell will be speaking to us specifically about the work of Georgia, and I think you're going to see some very interesting examples of how a state health agency leads work in with multiple partners, including legislators and agency aging organizations, bringing multiple people together. So Russell is the Deputy Chief of Staff for the Georgia Department of Public Health. And actually, prior to being in that role, Russell was in the governor's office working in planning and budget. He also worked in the Department of Labor, so he really brings a rich focus and understanding of across government work, and then bringing that into the public health world. So you're going to be hearing a lot more from Russell in some very specific examples. But with that, what I'd like to do is now mention that I have no disclosures to make. I will indicate that it's through CDC funding that ASTO has been very fortunate for a number of years to be working in the area of aging and healthy aging. Just a little brief tidbit about the Association of State and Territorial Health Officials. We actually represent 50 states, the District of Columbia, and 8 territories, so we actually cover 10 time zones. So you can imagine the complexities that brings, but also the richness that brings of our membership. Not only do we have those critical leadership members throughout our country and our nation and our territories, but we also support the leadership teams within state health agencies, which are a critical component and partner in our work and in accomplishing our work. To that end, And I really want to take a moment here to pause on ASTO's important affiliates. We have 20 formal affiliates that work with ASTO. And I mentioned this in particular, and I think Dr. Mullen will speak to this too. These are individuals that we really see as leveraging to help contribute to the work of healthy aging in our state health agencies. By way of example, the National Association of Chronic Disease Directors, critically important in our work. The public health laboratorians, the Council of State and Territorial Health Epidemiologists, the National Association of State Offices of Minority Health, all these affiliates are critically important in helping us collectively accomplish our work together. These associations are standalone associations, and they're, again, an affiliate of ASTO, and they represent the public health experts in our states, both at the state and often at the local level. So with that, I want to share with you a couple of conceptual models, and Dr. Mullen will also be sharing the National Prevention Strategy model too, but I want to take a moment just to have you understand how we and our members actually frame our work and look at our work. So we use the socio-ecological model. There is hardly any of our work that we don't really think about from that individual, that relationship, the organizational, the community engagement, and then the policy and systems work. So it's really that wholeness that we really approach our work and really look at where do we have best practices and where do we have gaps. Another model, this is one that we've all seen and frequently, is a health impact pyramid. And I bring this to light, and again, I know many of you have seen this model in conceptual framework, but I think it's important today as we're speaking about healthy aging and really looking at what we're trying to do is to consider where we're going to have our most impact, where do we have some of our most opportunities. And obviously in the area of socioeconomic factors is a key area, the largest impact, but often what we do have for best practices really end up being in that productive interventions, changing context. Often we go to the counseling and education. I also want to mention, though, and I don't think it's, we want to miss this point, that in this environment of linking public health and primary care and clinical services together, there's some significant opportunities to be made in that area. Another framework that I think is critically important as we think about our work together, as we look at patients and families in the community, is looking at the multiple partners that it takes to do this work. And it's really through this lens, and you're going to see this in several places throughout our presentation, that it takes multiple partners to do this work, that this is not just the work of a state health agency or a local health department or a clinical practice or an area agency on aging. It's our collective work together. And that's really what we're trying to represent here, that if we're really going to achieve better, longer living, then we really need to be looking at what can we all do to contribute to that. So with that, I think it goes to say that there are some critical federal partners in this work. We, ASTO, and our members often talk about the public health enterprise. So at the federal level, two obvious critical partners are CDC and the Administration of Community Living. Those are probably the two obvious. But needless to say, we also need to be thinking of federal partners such as SAMHSA, particularly in the area of substance abuse and mental health and depression and aging, for example, and HRSA, again, a huge infrastructure in terms of our FQHCs and what is their role in supporting the aging individuals in our communities. I want to now take a moment to talk a little bit about a very specific area of work that ASTO has done that's led up and helps continue to build on the work that Dr. Mullen is leading us in her challenge this year, and specifically the Healthy Brain Initiative. This was done in collaboration with CDC. It really is a focus around Healthy Brain Initiative with a focus on what public health can bring to the table in this work. So I'm just going to give you a quick run through of the, again, the model that they're using as we consider this work. And what I would offer us to think about as we're thinking about healthy aging, that we not forget the cognitive health. We often think of physical health, emotional health, but have we really, really put our hands around the cognitive health? And here's a tool that will actually be critically important in helping inform that work. So the roadmap actually pulls you through from a planning to interpretation, critical components, analysis, huge aspect, and again, you're going to hear some of the work from Georgia, is really about understanding what are the incidences of dementia, et cetera, in their state. Again, a familiar model for public health, you know, with our core functions of assessment, policy development, and insurance, with looking at applied research and translation. I will tell you that ASTRO is involved right now in working with the community guide on trying to identify evidence-based interventions, particularly around caregiving. So again, with that center focus on research and then the translation, or I would say implementation of best practices. And then throughout the roadmap, you'll see there's this particular focus on where do we monitor and evaluate. And again, I think George is going to be a great example of that work. To educate and empower, to really understand and bring forward the importance of cognitive health, to develop policy and mobilize partners, and to assure a competent workforce. And this is an area that I think as we look at healthy aging, for us as public health practitioners to really think, have we really informed and do we have the public health workforce that is ready to contribute to this work? So building on the work of healthy aging, there are several other areas that ASTRO has worked on that have led up to, again, the challenge of this year. We're very pleased that we have actually 5 demonstration states. This is a model that ASTRO often uses in its work, identifying early states that are ready to move and really bring together public health and aging. Again, Dr. Mullen has led that work in Connecticut, Brent Fitzgerald in Georgia, and Retta Ward has joined us with New Mexico, Lillian Shirley from Oregon, and then our health official, Wendy Baron in Wyoming. All are bringing together teams, cross-cutting teams. This is not only public health and state health agencies, it's really multifaceted teams. So these are just some examples of the work that we've done to date. And I want to bring your attention to the last point here around our website. And we do have some flyers that, I know, with our website. And one of the things that ASTRO does as we're pulling together and developing a President's Challenge is really identifying what the resources are out there. We often don't actually create those resources ourselves. What we're about is trying to help link the public health experts to each other and make sure that we're all aware of what's out there in this area of healthy aging. So I would offer to you to go and look at this site and please contribute to that site. We're more than happy to make linkages to that. And I'm just going to at this point point out Lynch Shaw, who's sitting right up here. She's the mastermind behind all this presentation and this work that's gone forward, and the mastermind of our website. So you'll, she's a great contact to help us continue to build that point of, if you will, a clearinghouse of best practices in this area. This side, I just want to now transition very quickly to a key point that is another way that ASTRO approaches its work, and particularly as we're leading into a challenge, is to develop a strategic map to really help guide our work and really help focus our work. And as you can see here from this list, this isn't done in isolation. We do not develop these strategic maps alone, but really actually pull multiple partners together to help inform and development of strategic map. How many people in the audience, I know several of the AFTO people know our strategic maps, but how about others? Are you familiar with our strategic mapping approaches? It's different than a strategic plan. It gives you in about a day and a half a one-page map, and literally it is a map. I'm going to show it to you in a minute. To help direct you. And then, of course, all the work is behind the scenes in making that map into action. So this is our strategic map that is leading and helping frame our healthy aging work. Let me just point out a couple of things. So the oval circle at the top is our central challenge, to improve healthy aging using population-based strategies. That's what we believe really is a critical contribution of public health to the aging community and the aging experts that we work with. Another area are the boxes, if you will, our strategic objectives, A, B, C, D, E, and let me just take a moment to mention a couple of those. I'm not going to go through this whole slide, but I want to bring your attention to this area, because I think as you hear our presentations, you'll see where this work is already underway in terms of mapping. But obviously, the identification and dissemination of tools, such as the website that I was speaking to earlier, the implementation of policy and advocacy initiatives, that's critical, and we know that we need to do that together with our multiple partners. We've already talked about the workforce and how critical that is, but also really understanding our programs that we do in public health, but do they have that lens of healthy aging to it, and what can be done more in that area? Fostering age-friendly communities. You're going to hear some wonderful, rich examples from Dr. Mullen's work. And also critically important is securing that financial resources and infrastructure. We were just talking earlier that public health may have its infrastructure, but the aging community may not have that. So what can public health bring to that conversation and that understanding? The last thing on this strategic map I want to particularly bring your attention to are the crossbars, if you will. We call them the underpinnings, if you will, that are critical. Excuse me. This would be F, G, and H, which is to address the social determinants. The expert group actually felt that it was critical to also call out to identify and implement strategies to increase health equity. And they saw that as a separate area of work from addressing social determinants, and also to expand and strengthen public health and private partnership. So again, critical underpinnings to this overall work. So with that, excuse me a moment. I'm going to take a quick drink of water here. So I'm now about to turn this over to Dr. Mullen, and what I wanted to do as we're talking repeatedly about her president's challenge is to give you an understanding that actually we've had several years that we've built on the work of the AFSO's president's challenge, and these are some of the ones that have gone before Dr. Mullen, and each one of them actually builds on itself. And I just want to recognize Albert Trullian, who was instrumental in helping us launch many of these President's Challenges, and what it takes to really bring this work to a high level and to actually show impact. And as I indicated, each one of these really builds on itself, as you can imagine. So these challenges are, although they're a year-long president's challenge, what AFSO has found through this work that it's actually only the beginning and often the important basis for the work that comes forward, and that much of this work actually continues to be built on in the years following. So with that, I am very pleased to present to you Dr. Jewel Mullen, President of ASTO, and with that, her challenge, and she'll be speaking too.
Thank you, Sharon. When you sit in the front and you don't keep turning around, you're not quite sure whether or not there's one person out there or many. So good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for being here. It's my privilege to talk to you about this work. And hopefully, since I believe you all are in here because you care about the topic already, you're going to walk out feeling affirmed, motivated, and knowing that there's somebody else out there who is trying to raise their voices for older adults in the same way that many of you might be already doing in your own work. So I happen to be an internal medicine doctor, and I happen to have grown up in a community with multiple generations, and I happen to be one of six living generations in my family. So the youngest is about 18 months old, and the oldest is my grandmother, who's 107. So I have many, and still is very cognitively intact. So I have, in addition to my professional experience, a lot of life experience that fortunately has taught me from a very young age the importance of valuing older adults. As a doctor who's worked a lot with interns and residents, I know how often residents avoided taking care of older people if they could. They gravitated to pediatrics, cute kids if they could. And oftentimes, they never realized once they saw somebody in a hospital bed that those individuals actually were walking around and living very fulfilling lives before something landed them in the hospitals. And as a public health practitioner, I'm very aware of how sometimes there's just not that much money left over by the time you finish funding all the other things that get funded in public health, especially front-loaded on the maternal child health side. So those are my personal descriptions, and these are my disclosures. I have none to disclose, no relationships. My agency does get CDC grants, but I have no commercial or other relationships related to this. So, living longer, better. My healthy aging challenge, as I describe, is living longer, better. This is a picture of a gift that was given to me when I left the community in Western Massachusetts, where I had been the medical director of a neighborhood health center. And from my neighborhood health center, I collaborated with a nurse who ran a program, a senior center program, and together we decided we wanted to work with the older adults, age 60 to 90-something, and we started this program, Living Longer Better, which was basically an effort to empower older adults. It wasn't a chronic disease self-management program or based on anyone's model, but was one in which we worked with these community-dwelling elders who I would usually see for an hour and a half or two once a month during one of the days when they were there for their lunch program. And I would take the medical residents with me so that in addition to my being out there, it gave me a way to take residents to interact with older people in the community. And the empowerment part was that we would do role plays, such as, okay, so you don't like the way your doctor does or doesn't talk to you, so let's role play it with a resident. You can practice your skills, and you can give them feedback on the ways in which they do or do not interact well with you. Additionally, we talked about mobility. We talked about they participated in farmers market and community gardening programs, and I would ask them to tell me what they wanted to talk about. But since some of the participants were my patients, I also knew about the men who at the beginning of every month, when their checks would come in, were coming and talking about the women out on the street who knew they had just gotten their check and were available to provide services for fees. So it also gave me a chance to talk to them about safer sex, which they very much appreciated. And what I started doing was showing up every month with condoms. And at first people would say no, and I would just say, give them to your grandkids. You know they probably talk to you, give them to your grandkids. But after a while, you know, every month the bag would be empty. And then after a while people would say, did you bring any condoms this time? So it was a really important lesson, something I got already, but also for the residents to hear what the adults were trying to convey, which is, we might be older, but we're not old. That's what they said. We still have full lives that we want to live. And so, living longer, better. We bonded. I had a great time. And I feel that not only did we teach them new ways to walk in and feel like they could be in control of their health in the doctor's office, it also took at least a small group of residents and helped them see older adults differently. So that gets into my trying to get people to think about not just people being sick, but how they maintain their health as they age, healthy aging. And when I say healthy aging, and usually people start talking about healthcare costs, Medicare, Social Security, broken hips, dementia, and most people usually have a story about something that they're going through with a family member because so many people are caregivers or watching someone else be a caregiver, or they're just dealing with hard issues such as, can you still live safely in your home, or is your community safe enough for you to be there anymore? So this, by Blind Man and the Elephant Slide, is just a reminder that even the notion of healthy aging conjures up many different concepts for people, but they're all relevant. And they all fall into that whole core of all the different models that Sharon showed a little while ago, if we think about all the aspects of life and well-being that would really constitute living and aging well in a community. Back in the 90s, I did a postdoctoral fellowship in psychosocial epidemiology, focused on social determinants, and it was on healthy, what we then were referring to as successful aging, which we tend not to use as much now, because if we consider the success not having disease, not having chronic conditions, we've already pretty much judged that you haven't aged successfully if you fall into the category of, say, the majority of older adults who have at least chronic conditions by the time they hit age 65. So instead, I really prefer the NACDD definition, the development and maintenance of optimal physical, mental, and social well-being and function in older adults. And you know, as Sharon reinforced a number of times, as we, I believe that this incorporates the cognitive aspects as well. So I have personal interest. I'm really privileged to be asked the president, and I, even though if anybody's ever been the president of an organization, you also know it's a lot of work. I'm very privileged to be asked the president, and it's a joy to actually have a platform in which to advance this work. And even if it was just my personal passion, it's an imperative for our country to be doing this, because of the shifting demographics in the United States, where we're looking at the likely doubling of the U.S. population age 65 between now and, say, between 2040 and 2050, along with an increasing diversity of our population. Although, just because we're not going to necessarily create a more diverse population of people who are, say, 55 or 60 now, the diversity is going to be manifest even more in the younger age groups than in the older age groups in the coming couple of decades. But still, there's a growing diversity. And that also becomes relevant as we think about something I'll touch on a little bit more later, which is caregiving. because in a country with a declining birth rate, though not as low as some other countries, and fewer people to care for older adults, we have to really think even more about who will the caregivers be, and how does that play out in our country, where people want to, whether or not they're able to age in communities or in facilities, you still also end up having to butt up against sometimes racial and ethnic discordance, which also gets into the caregiver dynamic, and we need to think about that. So my grandmother, just another example, my grandmother decided to go into a nursing home when she was 99. You know, my uncle and my mother had been trying to get her to go into one for a while. And I'm sorry for the anecdotes, but I think they're salient. And yeah, I grew up in a nice New York City suburb, and so did my grandmother. So, but one of the realities for many older people who go into nursing homes, depending where they are, is sometimes it's the first time they live in a very integrated environment. When you think about where people live in their communities, sometimes they're not that diverse. So that becomes issues for families, issues for caregivers, and if, you know, if they're like my father was when he was in a nursing home and demented and disinhibited, it also sometimes makes people say things that don't go well in the dynamic. You're laughing. Do you have an experience with that? Would you like to share? No? So, but seriously, as we think about trying to set up all the systems that support people and families well, there are the things that, you know, sometimes either we don't realize they're in the air, but that we need to think about and plan for, even as we think about developing the public health and healthcare workforce to care for the future. And along with that, as well, with the increasing diversity, we've already talked about ASSO's focus on health equity. We understand that there are health disparities along the way. I just got an email that popped up yesterday from a reminder about an aging research conference in Chicago in March, and it was a did you know, maybe some others of you got it too, that just cited that 15% of older adults live in poverty, and that in the next 16 years there will be 11 million older adults living in poverty. There are going to be racial and ethnic disparities, and that did you know cited that there are more women and ethnic minorities among the lower income groups. And as we know from other public health work, there's a link between even things such as self-rated health, self-perception of health, and economic status. So it's important for me and for us, as we think about healthy aging, not just thinking about absence of disease, also not just thinking about longevity and thinking you have it made just if you happen to add more years to your life. Because the key for physical, mental, and emotional and social well-being is really to have a healthy life expectancy. And that's the focus here. And, you know, I think the maps that I'm showing are interesting for lots of different reasons, but they're also consistent with what we've seen in other maps if you just look at things such as where's the stroke belt, or, you know, where's the greater disproportion of obesity in the country. So, state-specific healthy life expectancy at age 65, and you see the geographic variation. If you can't see, can you see the key at the bottom? So there up in the upper central and western states, higher numbers of healthy life expectancy, broken down by gender, women do better, and by race, you see the differences among blacks and whites. So, certainly there are geographic considerations on a macro level, and thinking about place beyond that, we know that wherever people are, in general, they're still continuing to live in their community settings rather than in nursing homes. But sometimes, you know, I look at this 93%, and sometimes I wonder if that isn't a little bit high, that 93%, 65 and older, are in the community. And maybe it's just because if I looked at 75 or 85, the proportion living in congregate or long-term care settings would be higher, but I would have to look at those data to be sure. So for my challenge, considering that most people are in communities, it really makes you think about, well, what does that mean? Now, having been through a number of storms and disasters, or even thinking, as we're here in New Orleans, about what happened during Katrina, sometimes we don't know who's older and vulnerable in our communities until something happens, like the power going out, or floods, or water shortages, or other things that have happened. And certainly that was the case for us in Connecticut. As a physician, when I was still doing clinical work, sometimes I didn't really know who was living in certain parts of our state until the profile of an older adult in Western Massachusetts or Western Connecticut sometimes was the person who lived at home in their old, big old house with maybe somebody checking on them every now and then. And we really only knew they were there when they fell and somebody finally found them and brought them to the hospital. So the notion of being able to live long better, to live and age well in communities, and is one that really does get us to think about social determinants and all of the non-traditional factors that influence health, because that's what needs the attention to make sure that those who do stay in their communities can live and age well and safely. And alongside that, there are the fundamentals around being able to promote active living and healthy eating. And this is where, when Sharon mentioned the model that I was going to be talking about, as you'll see, it's my challenge is really based on a national prevention strategy framework. Are you all familiar with the national prevention strategy? Yeah. So active living, not just, you know, having people be able to get to a gym or to a Y, but to also think about healthy community design, programming that enables older adults to be active and safe. Alongside that, though, on the clinical side, ensuring the increasing use of clinical preventive services. And while here, injury prevention in Connecticut, falls are the most common injury-related cause of death among older adults, we talk a lot about falls. I also want to underscore that in our state, as we talked a lot about gun safety, firearm safety over the past few years, and talked about intentional self-inflicted injury, suicide was a most common, or suicide deaths were most common among older adults in our community. So on the injury prevention side, not just to think about those the physical injuries, but suicide and self-harm. And then once again, to think about all of the systems that need to be in place to support an aging population that inevitably, and I think I have to say inevitably at this point, will have a proportion of people that will suffer cognitive decline. I showed the preventive services slide around immunizations and screening, but even on the cognition and dementia side, there are, you know, the majority of conditions that meet the criteria for dementia go undiagnosed at the beginning. People cover. Clinicians don't screen appropriately. Sometimes the screening is not with the individual, but with the family member, but the family member is not there. You know, in settings where I've worked, perhaps what was considered non-adherence was actually related to. I'm really hitting on stuff. I'm so glad you keep shaking your head in a way that, thank you, but you're not the only one. Not adherence. Sometimes it's really a cognitive issue. So, and A lot of people don't report. And for those who do have an identified memory loss, they also end up needing more assistance with their ADLs and IADLs. And among them, for people who do need assistance, they most commonly get that assistance from a family member or a friend. And those tend to be people who are not identified as formal caregivers. They just become somebody else trying to help pick up the slack to support friends and family. So with over 80% of baby boomers wanting to stay in their current homes or age in place, the demands for caregiving in our country are, I would say, astronomical. Some of the work that we've done, and that ASTHO had been doing with CDC, as Sharon mentioned, even before I launched the challenge, was with Dr. Anderson at CDC's group, looking at creating, I think, a broader evidence base on effective strategies to support caregivers. So we have the issue of really, one, needing to create in our society a mechanism to have people who are informal caregivers, which means they usually have a second job that's unpaid, to find supports for them, but then and have those supports be some that are effective for them in an instrumental way, at the same time that they can attenuate the likelihood that those people will become stressed and depressed and burdened and guilty. So in our work with CDC, I've appreciated being able to reference their Healthy Aging Call to Action, which includes the Healthy Brain Initiative Roadmap. Sharon already showed the profile of the Healthy Brain Initiative, addressing LGBT aging and health issues. And I suggested to Dr. Anderson, and she thanked me, that I actually would just say addressing healthy sexuality in older adults, period. I mean, HIV is a chronic disease now. In our state, you know, the majority of folks who are HIV positive are over the age of 55. You know, hepatitis C and baby boomers. So there's a lot there, including LGBT youth health issues. Data and surveillance, addressing the psycho and behavioral issues, and then also in the Healthy Aging Call to Action, increasing vaccination rates for shingles. So with that, and based on the National Prevention Strategy, where the goal is to increase the number of Americans who are healthy at every stage of life, my appeal is that we not put an age limit on that every stage of life, because we don't necessarily always think about the full spectrum. Or sometimes, you know, I will concede, and I often say, it helps to be a healthy kid to become a healthy older adult, but there is so much in that goes into assuring healthy life expectancy that we can't stop. And then with the strategic priorities of healthy and safe community environments, clinical and community preventive services, elimination of disparities, and empowering people, I think the prevention strategy gives us a natural framework on which to do healthy aging work. And these objectives of tobacco-free living, preventing alcohol and drug abuse, healthy eating, active living, mental and emotional well-being, reproductive and sexual health, and injury and violence-free living, once again, all fit into the core, like the essential elements of promoting healthy aging. And I've used this framework with state health officials. I've used this framework talking with a number of ASLO affiliates, because given the competition to use our public health dollars to do so much of the work that we know needs to get done, it's a lot less likely to take an initiative like this and have people see it as doable, sustainable, and successful if they think they have to start something new. So I refer to this healthy aging work as plain old public health, which might not sound like a very professional way of describing it, but to me it's plain old public health. It's core, it's fundamental, and I mean, technically we're still figuring out how to do it well for the younger generations too, but we need to be careful not to only focus on younger generations when we do it. So, from a national prevention strategy, advocate for older adults, think about this framework for people, older people. I ask you to remember the notion that people don't want to go into congregate settings. Their families usually don't want them to go into them either, but it ends up being where they want to be. People want to grow old at home. It requires caregivers to be and move around your communities well. There needs to be transportation access for older people. That's part of the community design that's needed. People, whether or not they have just had skills without a profession, or once they leave their formal work and retire, they still want to contribute and they have a lot to offer. Creating the opportunities for them to do that is key. And it adds to their meaning, and it shows our value for what they can contribute. They can continue their avocations and learn new things. My 65-year-old husband just started playing trumpet. He's having a good time in New Orleans this week. They still want to be in communities where they can be around other people, you know, places that where they can sit, where they can be interactive, where they're not segregated from the other generations. They want to have activities out in open space, or for some of them, you know, I'll use an example. You know, we've talked with the National Park Service about how they might and do leverage the use of the skills of retired epidemiologists to become guides, or to do some of the epi work out in the mountainous areas. People still want to have partners. They want to be connected. They want their social support. They want to be active, and they want to have fun. Whoever their partners are. And they need us to be out there with them. So I'm in this picture along with some other state health officials who traveled to Taiwan 3 years ago, where we visited an Aboriginal village where a physician working there had started, used her own money to start a senior center program. And we were there with the older adults, and we danced and learned about them, and it was terrific interaction. And I think anybody who takes the time to be among older people will get it more than somebody who thinks about the policies and programs for them without ever being with them. So in my call to action, I ask you to consider the broad notion of public health that gets beyond medicine and our core public health, but that includes transportation, includes working with the Department of Justice for elder justice issues. That includes working with the Department of Labor for older adults. I think you know where I'm going there. That if you work either in a state health or local health agency or in a community, that you consider that there are a number of affiliates that ASLO works with who have organizations close to you, whether or not they're AARP, whether or not they are affiliates such as the Association of State and Territorial Dental Directors, who are doing a lot of work to address the unmet oral health needs among older adults, the Association of Immunization Managers. But to reach out to your area agencies on aging, some of you might come from agencies on aging, to know that, you know, they might need, state health agencies might need you, and collectively you can do more work. That there's a lot of interesting and very important work that gets done as people's scholarship in academic settings, and that sometimes will become a project for someone in a small small population for falls prevention, for chronic disease self-management, for some kind of intervention around cognition. But if we don't find enough ways to partner with academia, that work's never going to be brought to scale in a way that benefits older adults the way that it needs to. I could go on, but I think I've given you some of the examples that I wanted to demonstrate. What I'd rather do is let Russell come up next and describe some of the specific work that's being done in Georgia. Georgia, as one of the 59 ASPHO members, is doing some specific healthy aging work. Next month, when I meet with my colleagues again, the state health officials, I will be presenting them a menu of activities for convening partners to do sustainable work in their states. And my goal is that together we start a movement that long outlives, well, maybe won't outlive me because I'm going to age well, but that at least will outlast my time as ASPHO president. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much. It is a pleasure to be here, and we're very thankful to ASTHO for having us and APHA as well. This is my first APHA, and I must say I am amazed at the size of this thing. It is truly remarkable. I also want to say thank you to ASTHO for all of their assistance along the way. What I'm about to talk about, I don't think we could have gotten to where we are right now without them. They've been a huge help to us in creating something that doesn't exist a lot out throughout the country, and we're hoping that what we do could be a catalyst for something that also South Carolina, West Virginia, New York City has done as well in terms of Alzheimer's disease and related dementias. It's a very important issue to us. It's a very important issue to me personally, as it is to a lot of people increasingly, unfortunately, in today's society. And what this really is it's a story about how an issue and awareness of that issue drove the creation of policy in Georgia is quite remarkable. I have a chair and talked a little bit about my background, but before getting into state government, I worked for a long time for legislators and politicians, and I'm thankful to not have to do that anymore, although that there are a lot of politics in what we do every day. But it's interesting on being on both sides to see how it works and see the process. And unfortunately, it doesn't always work. In this case, it did. so we start with, let me give a little background before I go into the slides. And so this started with the Georgia chapter of the Alzheimer's Association. We have a very good chapter, very, very good people that are very helpful. We work very closely with them. We work very closely with them, and also our Division of Aging, which is another sister agency. Georgia is kind of convoluted. We have four health agencies. We are but one. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. We've been a part of two other ones in the past 4 years, so we are now out on our own, which has made things like this easier for us to accomplish. It really has, being closer to the governor, better leveraging funds, that kind of thing. So the Alzheimer's Association had a great awareness campaign in the 2013 legislative session. Our legislative session is roughly 3 months, the second week in January till April something or another, depending on how long-winded some of them can be. And so they approached our health chairs, who are both nurses who both understand health. You don't always see that. And they talked about the need to create an infrastructure, state infrastructure, for awareness, education, and Alzheimer's care. It's very important. And as I'm going to mention moving forward, we basically had none. Except for the Alzheimer's Association, we didn't have a whole lot going on in terms of identification. And so they were very receptive to the idea. Now, Georgia, just like every other state, has had a lot of funding issues. We have, especially because we're 78% federally funded, and there's been a lot of funding issues on that end as well. And so we haven't been a lot of bills passed creating programs in the state agencies. But what they did was they created what they call a study committee, a very large one, that would meet during, not this past summer, but the previous summer, to talk about the issue and to make a proposed state plan, to give it to the legislature, to give it to the governor, and then it's up to them to fund, to create these issues, this infrastructure that so desperately needed to be created. And that did pass. That study committee did pass. It was a very large one. I've been associated with many of them, and this one had about 100 people tied to it. The committee itself, a lot of heavy hitters, all of the health commissioners were on there. The health chairs of the health agencies were on there. Also, two other legislators from the child and development committees were on there. And they talked about all of the issues related to Alzheimer's care, dementia care, and everything that needed to go into that. They divided it into subcommittees, and Dr. Fitzgerald, who I'm speaking on behalf of today, was the subcommittee chair for data and research. And it's appropriate because I mentioned before that public health has been a part of so many agencies. Before 2009, public health was in a mega agency that housed DFACS, it housed behavioral health, and many, many other things. Public health, unfortunately, was at the bottom. And there were some issues that led to the breakup of that agency after about 30 years. And in July of 2009, they decided to break apart a mega agency and create another mega agency. So they put public health in the Department of Community Health, which was Medicaid's Health Benefit Plan. Again, public health at the bottom. So a year and a half later, after recognizing this, they broke public health out on its own. July of 2011 was when they did that. Dr. Fitzgerald came along at that time, and we started a very difficult process of examining everything and turning things around. We were sending a lot of money back in federal grants. We weren't maximizing our resources. And I'm glad to say that now Dr. Fitzgerald has really turned it around so that we're able to do these things. And we want to be the agencies known for a lot of things, but primarily data. We have all this data that comes in. We get all of this data. We work with all of these agencies. And until just recently, Georgia Public Health wasn't really known for its data, and that was a shame. And that's something that we have and continue to really put on display for us and really do well. We have a lot of great people that help us here. So assigned to this committee, we had several really heavy hitters from Emory, from UGA, from all of these groups, and it became very evident quite quickly that we noticed that we couldn't answer the questions about Alzheimer's in Georgia because we didn't know. No one was working together to pull all these data resources together to say, well, what does it look like in Fulton County, which is where most of Atlanta is? What does it look like statewide? We think we know. We think we know, 130,000 seniors 65 and older have Alzheimer's or dementia, but we don't know for sure. That's just an estimate. So how can we figure this out so that we can get more resources dedicated to this issue? And the only way we can do that, and I know this, is to persuade policymakers. It's in competition with everything else out there, and the only way to do it is to make them understand why there's an issue and how they can help. And so we started working together. We started pulling all of our resources together to come up with some recommendations. And we have here is Renee Unnerman is the chairman of the Senate committee. The House committee is Sharon Cooper. And both of them were on the task force. They were very, very helpful in giving us completely away with what we wanted to do. And that doesn't always happen, but it's a great thing, and we're glad that they did do that. We just happened to notice from another state that it was West Virginia, actually, that they had created an Alzheimer's and related dementia registry. And that was very interesting to us because we had no way to really find out what the numbers were in Georgia. We contacted them with the help of ASTHO. We found out that actually South Carolina was the first state that created a registry. West Virginia copied their registry. New York also had a dementia registry as well. And we talked extensively to them about their experience, what it would be like, their best practices, their lessons learned, that kind of thing, and we really like that idea. And so we talked to the chair of the committee about it, and during one of the meetings, he said, "Well, I think we need to recommend that we do one of these things, and who's going to do it?" And without hesitation, my boss stands up and says, "We'll do it." And I thought, well. Uh-oh. So the reason I thought that was because they'd love to pass issues and then not fund them. And what happens is we'll scrape away money to do it one year, and the next year we won't have money and it goes away. I can't even begin to tell you how many projects we have that has happened to. And this is too important not to put a lot of focus on. And so it was one of the recommendations. There was a full, very thick plan that was actually just released about a couple of months ago for some final approval. And the next year, we were able to pass on the last day of our legislative session a bill that created an Alzheimer's registry. And it gave us almost complete leeway with how to put that together. And you never see that. It's always just filled with limits, and this was not. And I think that was a testament to their confidence in Dr. Fitzgerald to put it together. That's a very good thing. And so we said, okay, this thing passed. Now what are we going to do? So we enlisted the help of our best friends, ASTHO, to come in and moderate some strategic planning sessions for us. We thought and we thought and we thought about who to bring into this. And we came together with a number of resources and stakeholders to help us sit and kind of figure this thing out. Now, it's been a great thing for us dealing with so many stakeholders, but it's really necessary to manage expectations. When the bill passed, we begged for money. And when I mean begged, we begged for money. And we begged for an amount. You can always expect to get about 10% of that, which is exactly what we did. We got enough money to grossly underfund a physician, an epidemiologist, to come in and help us do this work, and who we've already brought on. We're very happy we did get that funding, and it was reoccurring funding as well. So we'll get it from year to year and year. And so we have that person in place. So because of the lack of resources that we have right now, when I talked about managing expectations, it's very important to, everybody wants to jump on this thing and they wanted to make it a population-based registry. They wanted just much like the cancer registries that we have in all of our states. We just simply don't have the resources to do that right off. And so what we're doing now is we're tying together all of the existing data structure that we have. Hospital discharge is something that we get from our hospital association. Vital records death data. We have added co-condition lists to death certificates and we're encouraging doctors to sign off on those. If someone has Alzheimer's and it was a co-condition, to list that. We use the BRFAS data. We're working on Medicaid is in a sister agency of ours. It's funny, we're not within the agency anymore, but we have a better experience with them now than we did when we were all together. So we're working on getting the data there. Medicare is a different animal for those of you who have ever dealt with ResDAC. We're working on that now. We have another agency, another sister agency that's working on a massive data request to them. We're trying to become a part of that so we don't have to pay for it. The State Health Benefit Plan is another agency that we're trying to get information on. And also, we are working on a pilot right now with UHS Pruitt, which is a very large nursing home conglomerate, especially in the Southeast. And to date, at least, they have been very amenable to helping us with some of the data that they have from the private pay world. And so we're working through that right now. Okay, so our main goals for this, like I said, we can't create a full-out registry where people are, you know, this is a population-based tracking registry. So we're using existing data sources, and what we plan on doing, and this is part of the ASTHO collaboration here, we have a plan, and it's always good to have a plan to move forward. And so we have decided that what we're going to do is we're going to create reports and show policymakers and the public this is what this disease is doing to our state. We've done some of this initially. It's great to watch people as they read through how a disease affects their community, you know, because they realize then. I didn't realize that, you know, 30% of my senior population has Alzheimer's, which is the case in some of our counties. And so we can at least do that to begin with. And what we want to do there is show them that there is a need to build upon infrastructure, show them that there is a need to provide more education. We're working with the Alzheimer's Association to get some of their toolkits for identification, getting through to physicians. How do I say this in a nice way? It's not always easy to do. It's not always easy to get them to help us with doing things like adding as a co-condition on the death certificate. But so far, we've had a lot of good help there from them. And so we want to do this report, give it to the legislature so that they understand the need to turn this thing into what it is. So it's not really a registry right now. It's a repository of data, but the plan is to turn it into a registry. It's not, although it wasn't specifically listed in the legislation as a mandate, West Virginia has a mandate, South Carolina does not. West Virginia's mandate, although, does not have any teeth to it. There's nothing in there that says you have to do this or we will, whatever. It doesn't say that. But they have a lot of compliance. It's not 100% because they have a lot of buy-in from policymakers and doctors' groups and hospital groups to get these things filled out. And so we have the ability, though, to make this mandatory if we would like. The politics of the situation there, though, is such that we don't know that we would be in a place to do this. But we certainly feel like with all of the stakeholders we've put together that we can make a difference by, you know, affecting them with the masses, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And so we're hopeful there that we won't have to make anything mandatory. We won't have to make this a notifiable disease, which is something that has been discussed. But it's the primary goal is just to bring awareness to everyone involved so that they know that this thing that they created in the legislature is moving forward, and that we are measuring this thing in Georgia, and I think that will go a long way to drive policy further. So I mentioned the stakeholder meetings that we did. West Virginia came along and presented. That was very, very helpful. We had another internal meeting. Just DPH people asked that came and helped us with that to put together the strategic plan moving forward for this, which we have already started implementing. I mentioned the MOU with Pruitt that we're very excited about. We're very happy and appreciate our relationship with them, and we continue to have monthly group meetings. This has kind of been put on hold over the last month and a half for reasons that I'm sure you all appreciate, but because we've been dealing with other issues, but we're jumping right back into it now, full force. So we do work with the Division of Aging in many, many, many other ways. And this is just an example of some of the other programs that we do with them. It's a sister agency. Dr. Jay Bilott is their director, and he is very, I guess you would say he's almost like a co commissioner with ours. He's very, you know, in tune with what we're doing, and we have him along. And we can't do this without them. We can't do this without any of our stakeholders. And we think that that's very important. And I want to lastly talk through a few things that lessons learned and things like that that are very important to us. Include as many stakeholders as you possibly can. There are upsides and downsides to that, but there's no way we could have gotten this to where it is, or we can get any further without all of them. Like I said, managing those expectations is very important, but everybody has to have a voice in this to make it a success. And then we, over the next year, we really want to work on the potential expansion of the registry, the opportunity to identify additional funding to help us expand, and additional data sources, the opportunity to work with like educational, like UGA and Emory, to leverage research funding. I think that's very important to us. By the way, this is the only out of the three that already exist. This is the only registry that doesn't exist in a university. This is the only strictly government-run registry. As such, we really want to make sure that our public health colleges are really in tune with us and helping us with this. And so that's my presentation. We're very happy about this. We want to expand it. We want this to be something that other states can learn from and adopt on their own and not be afraid of. I must have talked to 20 other states, and they're all worried about funding and keeping this thing going, and which I think has been an issue in New York actually. And so it doesn't take a whole lot of funding to do this if you get everybody on board, and that sometimes can be very difficult to do. So we want to make sure that we put together a plan that we can share with other states, that, and we would love to talk to any other state that may be interested and ask that can help with that as well, to put this together. Because what we would love to do is have some kind of consortium of states working together to show what entire regions look like for Alzheimer's. And so I think that would be our ultimate goal. But we're working towards that, and we're very happy for ASTHO's help on this. And like I said, if you have any questions or anything, please just give us a call, and we'd be happy to discuss. Thank you.